This is October the 3rd at the University of St. Thomas Jobeck Center. Tonight's event host, who's going to talk tonight?
We have Steve Kretzman, Stephanie Alston, and Dr. Owens Wheeler.
Okay, and you are?
David Closter. I'd like to welcome and thank each of you for coming this evening. We have with us tonight the Price of Oil Tour, which is sponsored jointly by Amnesty International USA, the Center for Constitutional Rights, Earth Rights International, the Ken Sarah Wheeler Foundation, and others. And in our own small way, we're contributing this by hosting this evening. My name is David Closter. I teach international human rights here at University of St. Thomas at the Center for International Studies. And as we participate in tonight's discussion, I'd like you to consider the issues that are being raised against a backdrop of questions. First question, what is the study of human rights? In the abstract, I tell my students it's a debate and a dialogue about power. It's a debate and a dialogue about the rules that we set to limit that power that people use against one another. So in its simplest form, it's a debate about sharing. It's a debate and a dialogue that each of us can, and in my estimation, must participate. But when we go from the abstract to the figurative, when we place a face and a place and time to the debate, we see that human rights becomes a struggle. People with power are very reluctant to give up their power. This often results in tragic consequences, as we'll see this evening. So how do human rights relate to the private sector and private industry? Contemporary discussions of human rights have centered on the relationship between citizens and their countries, nation states. This is most likely due to the atrocities that we saw after World War II and subsequent focus of attempt of the United Nations to curtail the abuses of power of nation states. This has not always been the case. When human rights are viewed as a curtailment of power, we see that normative standards have historically been applied to non-state actors as well. 130 years ago, human rights saw one of the greatest triumphs it had ever seen, and that was the abolition of slavery. Our normative standards were applied to individual slaveholders, not just nation states. 60 years ago, the Nuremberg trials held 13 people accountable for crimes against humanity. These were individuals, not nation states. Today we ask ourselves if those normative standards shouldn't be applied to new centers of power, namely the transnational corporation. This we refer to as a horizontal application of human rights rather than a vertical application. So as I turn the podium over to our guests, and they provide us a face and a place and a time and the struggle of Ken Sarah Wheeler, let us each ask ourselves these questions. What are the rules we wish to apply to the exercise of power, and to whom do we wish them to apply? Join with me in this debate and witness the struggle of Ken Sarah Wheeler and the dignity that was his life. It is with great pleasure that I stand here today with Steve Kretzman, Stephanie Alston, and Dr. Owens Wheeler, Ken's brother. Please join me in welcoming them with a roaring round of applause.
Thank you, David, for that beautiful introduction in the historical context of human rights. On November 10, 1995, internationally renowned author, playwright, human rights activist, and Nobel Peace Prize nominee Ken Sarah Wheeler was hanged with eight colleagues in a prison yard in Port Harcourt, Nigeria, by a military government. Their bodies were then dumped in an unmarked grave, with the hopes that both the men and the causes for which they stood for would be forgotten. This November 10th, 2005, marks the 10th anniversary of their deaths, and the world has not forgotten. Much has changed, but more has not. Nigeria has now emerged from decades of military rule and is a nascent democracy. Yet Ken Sarah Wheeler and the Ogoni 8 still remain convicted of a crime they did not commit. Oil companies continue to devastate Ogoni and the Niger Delta with impunity, while poverty and growing instability inflict Delta communities. Globally, oil dominates world affairs in conflict, climate, finance, development. And 10 years on, the world still remembers and needs Ken Saro-Wiwa. Ken Saro-Wiwa was a man of letters, a man of peace. He was very passionate in his belief about the possibility and the power of nonviolent struggle to win the rights for communities and for the environment. Those of us that knew him, even just a little bit, or knew of him during his life, missed his vision and his passion and his wit and his spirit, but we have not forgotten. We understand and view the oil industry as a source of global warming, environmental devastation, human rights abuses, war, national security concerns, corporate globalization, poverty, addiction, the list goes on. And Ken Saro-Wiwa was a very powerful and common point of inspiration for many in these realms of activist communities. We will remember Ken Saro-Wiwa and use his story to illustrate how oil affects indigenous communities and how the Ogoni struggle illuminates our own relationship to oil, to power, and to greed. Remembering Ken Saro-Wiwa reminds us all of our collective potential for change and the courage to act for that change.
We'd like to start off the program tonight by having a moment of silence for Ken Saro-Wiwa and his life, and we'll exit that shortly with a poem. Silence. The vows of silence, they must be kept. For you cannot speak while the guns roar, and you cannot cry where you'll not be heard for the loud resonance of an empty lie. Silence, and the vows of silence must be kept, or else where silence will be kept. Ken Saro-Wiwa.
To Saro-Wiwa, Rainmaker. We have returned with empty hands and hollow minds from the thunderstorm, raining blood, one mighty one whose wink brings rain. We did not pray for war, wash the stain of strife away. We'll speak no more of coups and colonials and raids at dead of night. We'll forget the bombs, build scores of tombs, and bury the dead. Receive us, mighty one, with a cleansing shower. Ken Saro-Wiwa.
This is the closing statement to the Nigerian Military Appointed Tribunal at Port Harcourt, Rivers State, Nigeria. My Lord, we all stand before history. I am a man of peace, of ideas, appalled by the denigrating poverty of my people who live on a richly endowed land, distressed by their political marginalization and economic strangulation, angered by the devastation of their land, their ultimate heritage, anxious to preserve their right to life and to a decent living, and determined to usher this country as a whole, a fair and just democratic system, which protects everyone and every ethnic group and gives us all a valid claim to human civilization. I have devoted my intellectual and material resources, my very life, to a cause in which I have total belief and from which I cannot be blackmailed or intimidated. I have no doubt at all about the ultimate success of my cause, no matter the trials and tribulations which I and those who believe with me may encounter on our journey. Nor imprisonment nor death can stop our ultimate victory.
Now we're going to start the panel. We have Owen Wiwa, who's the brother of Ken Saro-Wiwa. He's also the executive director of AFRIDA, the African Environmental and Human Development Agency, which is a research and development NGO that works in the resource-bearing communities of Africa. He's also a research fellow at the Center for International Health at the University of Toronto and at Culture, Communities, and Health Studies at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto.
Welcome to all of you. Before I start, I want to read some few sentences from my late brother. He wrote this in May 1995. That was about 5 months before he was executed. And he wrote it to a London newspaper, and it was published in the London Guardian. I'll just read the last paragraph. He said, "Whether I live or die is immaterial. It is enough to know that there are people who commit time, money, and energy to fight this one evil, among so many others, predominating worldwide. If they do not succeed today, they will succeed tomorrow. We must keep on striving to make the world a better place for all of mankind, each one contributing his bit in his or our own way. I salute you all." My brother, my late brother, was a man of many parts. We remember him most, you know, in his ability to turn events, bad events, into good, to make people laugh, even in their circumstances. Before my brother was executed, he was detained for 17 months. And within those 17 months, he wrote to me alone a total of 47 letters. I know that he wrote to one Sister Magella about 60 letters, and he wrote to several others. That means he was writing almost every day, sometimes 2 or 3 times a day. Writing was his passion. Before he was executed, he had written 27 books for children, adults, for everybody. And he produced a comedy, a television comedy in Nigeria called Bassey and Company, which was watched by 30 million people every week in Nigeria. I bring this background just to let you know that my late brother was well known in Nigeria by a lot of people, the powerful, the poor, and almost everybody who watches television or listens to the radio or could read one way or the other knew about him. He was also relatively well-to-do in the Nigerian context. But he lived frugally. But he sent his children to the best schools. He made sure that some of us also went to good schools. Education was very important to him. But despite the fact that my brother was all right on his own right, he wasn't happy. The majority of the Ogoni people could not eat 3 square meals a day, could not go to school, or if they went to school, there were no books for them to read, or the teachers to teach them, because the teachers could go for 6 months, or sometimes even 12 months without being paid by the government. He was not happy whenever he came to my clinic, because at the back of all this, I'm a physician, and they would see so many people with different types of diseases who could not afford their medicine and who could not be treated adequately. So my brother converted all his energy to forming MOSOP, the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, to try and reverse this trend of poverty in the midst of plenty. Why do I say plenty? I come from somewhere in Nigeria called Ogoni, which is really a small place. It is just about 40 miles by 50 miles in size. That is all that there is to Ogoni. And as of 1995, about 600,000 people lived there. But apart from the people, there were other interventions, if I should use that word. We had oil and gas companies, specifically Shell and Chevron. Within this space I've described, there were 100 oil wells, and which the companies have been producing oil from these wells since 1958. So by 1993, it was estimated that about $30 billion worth of oil and gas has been extracted from our land. Yet, as I told you, the people were paradoxically poorer. Why? Is it possible that so much oil could be present in a place or extracted from a place and the people who live there get poorer? This happened because of the method of extraction of the oil. My brother, despite his busy time writing, also traveled a lot. Before he died, he had gone to about 40 countries. And what he told me was that whenever he went to any country and he hears that there's oil being produced in that part of the country, he visits those places. My brother has visited this city. He went to Calgary. He went to several places. And he saw what oil could do at times. And he saw what oil did for us. What the oil extraction did for us was that it destroyed what was our livelihood. The process of extracting this oil was so crude that my brother used the term environmental racism to describe it, in that the process that was used in my land is very different from the process that they are using elsewhere. What process was used on my land? If you look at this picture, and some of this picture, and some of the pictures there, it will just briefly describe what was my home. Pipelines running between our houses. This is gas and oil pipelines laid above ground, bare. We also have gas flares right at the back of our houses. The gas flares were not stacked vertically, they were horizontal. It was like living at the back of an exhaust pipe, a huge exhaust pipe, bellowing smoke straight into the lungs. Now, the flaring of the gas was inefficient compared to what happens maybe around here. The flaring was so inefficient that what came out was a lot of nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide, and very, very dangerous hydrocarbons. And they went straight into our lungs. The asthma rate was very high, the cancer rate was very high, bronchitis very high, the rate of miscarriage was also very, very high. There were also a lot of skin diseases. We also have other problems. Water to drink was a problem. Why? Because these pipelines, as you see them, when there is a war in the Middle East, or if the winters are very cold out here, Nigeria is made to pump a lot of oil in order to fill the gap. These pipelines rupture, they burst. And when they burst, the oil and the gas go straight into our homes, on our farms, on our waterways. That means we don't have pipeline water, we drink from the stream. So the stream is polluted with oil. We don't have anything to drink. So we dig wells for us to get well water, but the underground water is also polluted. Because when the oil spills, they are not cleaned up in any way. The way Shell cleans it up is that it gives, calls on young boys, give them shovels to dig a big hole, then they put the oil into the hole and then cover it with sand. Of course, we all know what that happens. The oil just percolates down and contaminates the underground water. So what do we do next? We pray to God. Yes, we pray a lot. We are about 98% Christianized, and we go to church like 2 or 3 times a day when you go come home. We pray to God to send down the rain, and the rain comes. But when the rain comes, the rain is black with soot from the incomplete flaring of the gas. So I described a community whereby we were self-sufficient in our food. We drank clean water before Shell came. But after 20, 30 years of drilling, we found ourselves poor, sick, and we could not even have basic water that God gave to everybody, clean water to drink. My brother saw this and decided to mobilize the people. We formed the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People. And we are 500,000 in a country of 120 million as at that time. We are poor. And we decided we are going to use our brains to fight this battle. We decided we are going to be non-violent because of many reasons. One, well, we don't have the money to buy guns. We don't have the training for guns. And three, we decided that we are better off being non-violent. And we believe and still believe that non-violent struggle is the way to go. When you are confronted with this sort of diabolical enemies. The struggle went on, and it was relatively successful. Within a very short time, the Ogoni society was transformed in a way I cannot describe here because of time. We had friends with Greenpeace, people like Steve, who was in Greenpeace at that time, Amnesty International, the Sierra Club, Human Rights Watch, many groups around the world, unrepresented people's nations and people's organizations. We went to the UN in Geneva, one of the sessions, and we presented our case to one of the committees, and they listened to us. And we expected that Shell would at least listen to what we're saying. Because we wrote to Shell, talked to them, demonstrated, 300,000 people came out to have a peaceful demonstration for them to do one thing, or one or two things. Clean up the mess you've made of our environment. Remove the pipelines, for Christ's sake. In your country, you bury water pipelines are buried. And then you come to my home and put dangerous oil and gas pipelines at high pressure between my house and my farm in my streams because of profit. It's unacceptable. We ask them to change that. Simple. And clean up our place so we can farm and fish. Their response was to call us terrorists, communists, and give us all anarchists, give us all sorts of names. Convince the Nigerian people that what we wanted to do was to take away the oil from everybody and use it only for ourselves. Lies. And they went further. They bought guns and paid our soldiers to shoot at us, to kill people, to arrest women and rape them. They tried everything to cow us to stop the protest. We continued. The last of what they did was to hold my brother and a friend and said, and frame them up for murder. And they were executed 10 years ago. We have decided that we are not going to let that go. Because up till this moment, Shell has not apologized for what they did to us at all. The Nigerian government, the new Nigerian government, has listened to us and has returned the body of Ken and others that were dumped, which is the process of recovering that bone is the topic of this book, The Politics of Bones. The Politics of Bones talks about why we had the struggle, what Ogonis were, what happened to Ken, and how we were able to recover the body. The UN sent a fact-finding team, the United Nations, to Nigeria in 1996 to investigate the murder of my brother and his colleagues. And they did. And they came out with a report and a recommendation. In their recommendation, they asked the Nigerian government to pay compensation to the survivors of those that they killed. They also asked, and they said in their writing that the murder of Ken and the trial was against international law and was even against the Nigerian law. So the killing was illegal. The government also said, I mean the UN report also said the government should increase social spending in Ogoni, build schools, water, get water and roads and other things. None of those things have been done. We cannot in any way bring back Ken or the eight others. But we can at least say that their death is not in vain. And that is why we are on this campaign, to appeal to people, tell the story again, because this can happen again. Why do I say that? About 3 months ago, or 4 months ago, we buried my father. My father was died this year, and we buried him in June. 3 days before we buried him, Shell came out that they want to return to Ogoni. And they have started their tactics of divide and rule. We said, no, you can't kill our leaders. And then after 10 years, think everybody has forgotten. I want to come back and drill. Why does Shell want to drill in Ogoni? It costs Shell $2 to produce one barrel of oil in Ogoni, $2. Just $2. It costs now how many? About $50 or $60 per barrel of oil. It costs $2. The reason why it is $2 is because of the environmental deficit. The fact that they don't follow their procedures, the right procedure, which they think will be expensive. The fact that they refuse to bury pipelines. The fact that if people complain and want to take them to court or do anything, they get the police to arrest, to shoot them. The human rights abuse that goes on with oil production, the environmental rights abuse that goes on with oil production, is why we also ask people to be very sensitive when they use gas. Be careful. Because for every gallon of gas that comes from Nigeria, somebody's freedom goes. We know that we need gas to drive our cars. We're aware of that. We are advocating other forms of energy, but for the meantime, we ask that you tell the companies to be sensitive to the people who live in areas where they get the gas. The fact that we are Africans, we are black, does not mean that we don't want our trees to be green at all times. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
Next, we have Steve Kretzman, who's the founder of a new organization, Oil Change International. Steve has worked on energy issues in the global oil industry for the last 15 years, focusing on the intersection of environmental, human rights, development, security, and energy policy, and is a regular commentator on issues of corporate accountability, the oil industry, and environmental and human rights.
I'm actually going to talk about something a little bit different here than what I have been talking about at other stops on the tour, in part because it's Houston, in part because it's our first date with Owens. One of the themes that we've been talking about in the stops that we've done prior to this is this concept of the need for the separation of oil and state, and the fact that on a variety of different fronts, we're seeing an integration in between the state agenda and the oil industry agenda, which is problematic. I want to talk about that from some perspectives that might not be immediately obvious. The Royal United Services Institute, or RUSI, describes itself as a professional forum for the study of defense and international security. Located in the heart of London, RUSI is an incubator for the latest defense establishment thinking. It was no great surprise a couple of years ago for me to enter and find Robert Bud McFarlane, who was for a time Reagan's national security advisor, addressing a crowd of officers and bureaucrats. But the surprise in October of 2002 was his message. Greater security for Great Britain and the United States would be achieved not by building and deploying more aircraft carriers and tanks in the Persian Gulf, but by increasing energy efficiency and automobile fuel economy at home. National security would best be served, McFarlane argued, by focusing on reducing demand for oil at home. Focusing on the supply of oil will prove, in his words, ultimately inadequate. And this is from a man who once worked for Ronald Reagan, who removed all the solar panels from the White House. There was no discussion of climate change or the environmental impacts of oil addiction. There was absolutely no discussion of human rights issues, of cancer, Wiwa, of Nigeria, of Colombia, of Burma, of the many places we've seen these kind of things happen around the world. But the issue for McFarlane and others was simply national security. And after discussing various aspects of the costs of oil addiction, including the political and economic costs of maintaining security of supply within existing military intelligence capabilities, the symposium then reviewed the case overall and basically came to the conclusion that they had to get away from an oil-based system. This is not your father's clean energy movement. It's not the stereotypical image of what a clean energy movement has been in the United States. It's no longer the Greens and people on the left who are running around saying this is something we need, as it was perhaps 30 years ago. Today, the movement for clean energy and for a reduction in dependence on oil encompasses the entire political spectrum. Since the Second World War, and particularly since the Arab oil embargo of the 70s, successive U.S. administrations have equated national security with access to and control of oil, and in particular the Persian Gulf, which holds an amazing two-thirds of global oil reserves. Late in the Clinton administration, General Anthony Zinni told Congress that the U.S., quote, must have free access to the Persian Gulf's resources at all times, end quote. The Bush-Cheney administration, which I think is fairly described as of, by, and for the oil industry, we don't need to get into a debate here on that, is perhaps the ultimate expression of this oil equals security mindset. Even before September 11th, the extent to which the administration was guided by the perceived need for access to oil reserves was breathtaking. And the use of the military, whether through the threat or actual use of force, to ensure access to and control of oil in the Persian Gulf and around the world has never been clearer. 30 years ago, when the oil embargo shocked America, or 20 years ago when the Carter Doctrine, which was a doctrine that Jimmy Carter laid out saying we must always have access to these reserves in the Persian Gulf, alternative energy was in its infancy. But today, hybrid cars are being mass-produced, and prototype hydrogen fuel cell vehicles are being driven in California and in Washington, D.C. Testifying before Congress recently, former CIA Director James Woolsey, who drove to Capitol Hill in his Toyota Prius, spoke out strongly in favor of alternative energy technology and noted that, quote, there is no incompatibility between being a hawk and being a green. While that may be true, it's hard to imagine that a military fueled by hydrogen fuel cells and solar power would perceive vital national security interest in the Persian Gulf or in half a dozen other places, including West Africa, around the world. There's a problem. Despite a host of compelling economic, financial, environmental, national security, and just plain common sense reasons to reduce our collective addiction to fossil fuels, the Bush administration continues to drive us in the wrong direction. The first step is to recognize that we have a problem. Many, even on the right, are doing that today. And the next step is to demand a separation of oil and state. I want to give a little bit of overview of the politics of oil and why this is sort of the background behind it. Is the world running out of oil? And this is something we hear a lot about in the news today. Probably not is the answer. But since the oil crisis of 73, this question has regularly preoccupied the media and the public. The more important question is how much oil is there available on the market today and how much demand is there for it. Amazingly, no one actually knows with any reasonable degree of certainty how much oil is left in the world. We rely on Exxon and the Saudis to tell us how much oil Exxon and the Saudis have. Talk about the foxes guarding the hen house. 20 years ago, this seemed unimportant as everyone agreed there was more oil than the world needed at the time. But today, the world is approaching what geologists refer to as peak oil, the point at which daily demand will exceed supply. When this happens, we can continue to see increasing oil prices, the likes of which we're beginning to see now. Many mainstream geologists, energy investors, Matthew Simmons, who's headquartered here in Houston, and corporations think this could happen very soon in the next few years, although the U.S. government and most oil companies say it won't happen until about 2030. Adherents of the peak oil assume theory point convincingly to the fact that for the past 3 decades, the world has used more oil than it has found, and with recent briefings in the UK House of Commons and recent studies confirming fears by respected mainstream oil analysts such as PFC Energy, peak oil concerns are bound to play a major role in shaping energy decisions in the future. Not knowing the amount of such an important commodity in the global commons is simply unacceptable. There should be an independent international verification of reserves estimates made by countries and companies. Most observers agree that such transparency will reveal that companies, for instance Shell, and countries, particularly in the Mideast, have been drastically inflating their reserves estimates to their benefit for some time. That said, the thing to understand about global oil reserves is that under almost anyone's calculations, two-thirds of them are in the Persian Gulf, and it's an unavoidable and somewhat unpleasant fact that as long as we are dependent upon oil, we are dependent upon this region. Production varies from year to year, as the United States might receive more oil from Venezuela or Canada or Mexico or even Nigeria in any particular year, but in the long run, It's the Persian Gulf nations that are sitting on the mother load, and in particular, one country, Saudi Arabia, that holds more than a quarter of all oil in the world. It's the gas station to the global economy, and they say they have proven reserves of 264 billion barrels of oil. Saudi Arabia's importance to the global oil economy cannot be overstated. Today, the Saudis are producing about 9.5 million barrels a day, and oil has already passed the $60 a barrel mark and is continuing to hover in that range. The Saudis still say that they can bring yet more capacity online, but they haven't actually been able to do this, and they've been saying this now for months, if not years. The oil market does revolve around Saudi Arabia today. For the United States, the world's largest consumer of oil, this dependence on Saudi Arabia is not only a concern, it's a huge weakness, and understanding this weakness has driven U.S. security considerations for at least the last 30 years. In the early 70s, U.S. oil production reached its peak, and although the U.S. reliance on foreign oil had been increasing over time, there was always the comforting notion that there was enough excess capacity in domestic production that any disruption in foreign supply could be offset. But by the mid-70s, it was Saudi Arabia and not Texas which occupied the key position in the global oil economy. On October 20th, 1973, Saudi Arabia, followed quickly by other Arab nations, declared an embargo of oil shipments to the U.S. in retaliation for assistance to the Israeli military. The oil weapon, as they called it, had been used for the first time, and it was very effective. The embargo was lifted in March of the next year, but the power of the threat of that weapon has shaped U.S. energy and security policy since that time. 3 years later, before Congress, President Carter's Secretary of Defense, Harold Brown, testified that there is no more serious threat to the long-term security of the U.S. and to its allies than that which stems from the growing deficiency of secure and assured energy resources. In January 1980, the lingering fear generated by that embargo, combined with events such as the Iranian Revolution and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, forced U.S. strategists to draw a line in the sand. During what would become his last State of the Union address, President Carter specifically articulated that any attempt by an outside force to gain control of the Persian Gulf region will be regarded as an assault on the vital interests of the U.S., and pledged to defend that interest, quote, by any means necessary, including military force. 5 weeks after this, the U.S. Rapid Deployment Joint Task Force was formally established at MacDill Air Force Base. By the time Ronald Reagan took office, this force included 100,000 Army troops, 50,000 Marines, and additional Air Force and Navy personnel. In January 1983, this force became the U.S. Central Command, which 20 years later is overseeing the invasion and occupation of Iraq. 2 decades after U.S. CENTCOM was established, the U.S. military has clearly positioned itself to assert the Carter Doctrine on a global scale. 16 years after the fall of the Soviet Union, U.S. strategists know that the only real weakness in America's global dominance is her reliance on foreign oil. In March of 2001, newly appointed Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham unveiled the Bush-Cheney administration's process to create a new national energy strategy, quote, founded on the understanding that diversity of supply means security of supply. In truth, though, the strategy of relying on a diversity of supply to lessen U.S. dependence on the Persian Gulf had been in place for more than a decade. And although energy planners know that there is simply not enough excess oil in the world to displace the central role of Persian Gulf nations, the hope is that by maximizing sources of oil from elsewhere, such as West Africa, West African oil production, Nigerian in particular, is projected to quintuple overall, and Nigerian production is projected to triple over the next 15 years. So the kind of environmental problems that we're seeing and the kind of social problems that we're seeing in West Africa could definitely get a lot worse. If security of supply is indeed the Bush and Cheney's administration's goal, securing Iraq has gone a long way towards achieving it. Iraq holds the world's second largest reserves of oil. 11% of the world's known oil reserves are there. The U.S. Energy Administration estimates Iraq's possible reserves at 220 billion barrels, or 80% of current proven Saudi reserves. Geologists believe that the Iraqi West could hold another 100 billion barrels of undiscovered reserves. American officials have consistently and vehemently denied that oil was the motivation in the war. On 60 Minutes, Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld was asked if the war was about oil and responded, "Nonsense, it just isn't. There are certain things like that, myths that are floating around. I'm glad you asked. It has nothing to do with oil, literally nothing to do with oil." In private, though, one Bush advisor told a New York Times reporter that if you are trying to talk about Iraq and if you were not encumbered by the fear that your actions would be linked to ExxonMobil or their oil industry, you'd be talking about oil issues. Similarly, the UK Guardian reported that officials in Whitehall say privately that oil was more important in the calculation than weapons of mass destruction. And during the height of the conflict in the initial invasion, soldiers who obviously knew the real score set up forward bases named Camp Shell and Camp Exxon until Pentagon PR realized that this didn't look very good. For Bush and Cheney, national security clearly involves using the military to control the global supply of oil needed to fuel American consumption. And this makes sense. In fact, it's the only option that makes sense if you believe that there are no viable alternatives to oil. What we've heard from Owens, what we saw in the video, what the story of Sarah Wiwa and the Ogonis and all the people in the Niger Delta, similar communities in Colombia, in Burma, in oil-producing communities around the world show us is that there is a human price, an environmental price, to this conscious energy strategy of diversity of supply. We need to find a way to change this strategy. Over the last 5 years, the oil industry, the top five U.S. oil companies, have made $250 billion in profit. Over that same time, they've received $50 million in tax breaks and subsidies from U.S. taxpayers. 2,000 Ogoni were killed, including Ken. Enough is enough. We need a separation of oil and state. The first step after recognizing this problem is reducing oil's influence over our politicians and demanding political independence from big oil. If we're going to seriously embark on a transition to a clean energy economy, a transition that will help our economy create more jobs, clean up our environment, and make our nation and the world a safer and more secure place, we need to get oil out of politics. It's time that we do something about this. We need to tune up. We need to get the dirty oil money out of our political system, and once it's gone, the possibilities for a sound economy, clean energy, peace in Ogoni, peace in the Niger Delta, and national security will be much brighter. Thank you.
There are questions from the audience that we'll repeat due to recording constraints. Question asked was about the economic forces that create a culture of oppression in Nigeria.
In our campaign in Mosul, it was two-faceted against the Nigerian military dictatorship and Shell. For the Nigerian military dictatorship, we set on the process of democratizing the country because we felt that if there is democracy, we'll be able to hold the companies accountable. But we've noticed that even now that we've achieved some level of democracy, the sheer power of Shell, of companies like Shell, over our elected leaders is so much. And the corrupt use of the power they have is the problem that we have. So we see the companies as actually a threat to our democracy. And some would say that all the communities in Nigeria should do what the Ogonis have done. Let's throw them out. And in that way, you know, we can really have true democracy where we don't have the overarching influence, you know, that sort of diverts, you know, the politicians from what they should really do. That's to be accountable to the people. So we try as much as possible to do it too, but we can't do it alone because, you see, the companies really, we are small. The companies depend on the consumers, you know, those who buy from them, you know, for them to exist. And that's why we go on, you know, on tours like this to ask people that you also have to do your bit. If we drive away Shell and die for it or send an exile for it, all we beg for you to do is to send a message to Shell that their method is unacceptable to your ethics.
A couple of things to address your question. In the case of Nigeria, as Dr. Wewa mentioned, you actually have an unbelievable imbalance. Oil accounts for 80% of Nigerian government revenues, and Shell in particular accounts for 50% of Nigerian government revenues. So there is actually a lot of credence, particularly in that economy, to the idea that the corporations, and particularly Shell, pull some very important and very heavy strings. That said, yes, these are, when you're talking about oil-producing nations, these are sovereign nations. They make choices on their own. However, they're all part and parcel of the international economic system. You heard Stephanie mention that something I've done for the last couple of years was part of the World Bank's Extractive Industries Review. What that review looked at was World Bank assistance to developing countries for oil and gas in particular, and whether or not that had fulfilled the World Bank's mission of alleviating poverty and helped people and helped those governments develop, and the people on the ground develop. And what we found over the course of 2 years was basically the World Bank was unable to come up with a single instance where their support for an oil project or a gas project had actually alleviated poverty on the ground. Oil industry is a very capital-intensive industry. It's not a very labor-intensive industry. It doesn't generate a lot of local economic benefit for the people on the ground. There can be some employment quickly during construction phases, and there's much more employment for expert labor who you tend to come from the west or the north. It's not a good way for one to base their long-term economy. It is an excellent engine for generating cash, which happens to then turn around into an excellent engine for generating debt payments back to the IMF, the World Bank, Northern corporations. And so what we see when you actually get inside this system is that the money that's being generated, a huge proportion of it, is flowing right back to the north in terms of debt payment and not filtering down to the ground. That said, there are a lot of very important things that can and should be done in terms of transparency and accountability of local host governments as well as corporate. And all of those things are very worthy. No country has ever drilled its way to prosperity or democracy. There's this myth, which I call it the Beverly Hillbillies myth, that like you're going to strike oil and then everything's going to be fine. It's never happened. It's never happened, but it's out there. And so there's a desire on the part of, and because, I mean, the attraction is clear. There's a lot of money to be had. And if you could only do the right thing with that money, if governments could only manage that in the right way is the hope, then maybe they could create a benefit for all their people. For a variety of reasons, which are pretty complex, that has never happened yet. And so a lot of us think it's sort of, when it's become so complex that it hasn't been able to happen yet, it's probably not a system that's going to work.
What are some of the tactics that Ken Sarawiwo used in struggle, and discuss the trip that you just returned from last night?
I mean, what we did was really simple. One, we created awareness among the people, and it was very easy because the impact of oil affected almost everybody, and almost no person was having any benefit. So, having mobilized the people, we just one day, 300,000 people went into the streets. Some couple of thousands went to the oil fields, and said, we own these oil fields, we don't want Shell back. And that was it. We just stopped them one day. And then they've never been able to come back. They tried to come back, by doing what they did, human rights abuses and all that, but we just refused to let them back. And that is our struggle. Simple. Yes, they killed. Now they want to come back, and we say no, especially the women. And when they couldn't access the oil fields, through the road, they tried to come through the air, with helicopters. So the women just stayed on the pad, so the helicopter could not land. So the oil stopped to flow. That's in that aspect. And then, as any arrest or any killing on the oil fields or due to oil affects me quite a lot. You know, my brother was arrested several times. So many thousands of Ogoni people were arrested several times and tortured. I faced my own particular arrest 3 times. And on this one that my brother was arrested, I was also declared wanted for the same reason. So when I hear that anybody was arrested because he's protesting against oil, big oil, I try to go there. And that's what happened in Ireland. 5 men were protesting against Shell. Shell was trying to lay pipelines around near their houses and on their field to take oil and gas in the Mayo fields, that's in Western Ireland. And they said, no, we won't let this happen. So Shell went to court and got an injunction, a court injunction restraining the men from protesting. The men said they were going to disobey the injunction. So the judge put them into prison for contempt of court and said they would only come out when they agreed to obey his judgment. So they were in prison for 94 days, and they refused to say they were going to come out. So the Irish people organized a national rally, you know, against Shell, and invited me to come and lead the rally. So Shell heard about that, you know, and when I was on the plane going to Ireland, they hastily went to the judge and told the judge that they are removing the injunction. And so the judge freed the men. But the rally still went on, and about 5,000 people came out, and we had a big anti-share rally. So that was a huge success, because if we can defeat these companies, you know, in small bits, it will show that something can be done.
What role do the arts play in the struggle against the oppression?
Oh, quite a lot. In Ogoni, we used the arts in everything we did. Until 300,000 people came out to demonstrate, and nobody was injured. There was no injury, nothing. We had people dancing. We had people reading poetry. We had people, you know, entertaining, you know, while we were demonstrating. And Ken used the arts. We all used the arts. If you go to Ogoni today, and if they are going to celebrate November 10, you will see, you know, different types of plays. People depicting, you know, the arrest, the detention, the dancing. It had a lot. It's all about life. It wasn't on one side. It was at the center. Because Ken was a writer, a businessman, but he liked to regard himself as an artist. So it had a lot. Thank you.
How can you help the people that are there living to change things and struggle while you are locked into the culture?
You see, the question is very important. One of the key things in our struggle, one of the things that we said that we will not do is to look pitiful. We never wanted to ask for charity. We wanted to fight our way out of poverty because we were rich. Before the oil people came, we never begged. So even up till this moment, I still find it difficult to ask. And when I go home, the women, you know, who have really, really been at the forefront of this struggle, do ask me. People have died. People have been raped. What have we gained? You know? And it becomes tougher for me still because of this issue of dignity. However, having said so, we have about 200 Ogonis here in Houston. And many of them, you know, have been doing a couple of things at home. And they said that the people in their churches have been helping. And so they bring books, you know, to the schools. We've also had some people from here actually travel to Ogoni. Steve Kretschmann has been there. And each presence, you know, means a lot. So one thing you can come. I can come and say, you know, we'll dance together. But whatever you can do, there are Ogoni organizations, you know, that are doing some work in Ogoni, building schools, of course, churches, so many, you know, too many. You can sponsor an Ogoni child, you know, to school and all that. There are people who do them, I don't. Yeah, but if you go to, we have the Ken Sarawiwa Foundation, which has just come on board, and we do accept donations. If you write, if you go to a website, writeaction.org, and you write a check to them, and write for Ken Sarawiwa Foundation, the money will get to the foundation, and it will eventually get to the people.
And finally, a comment on boycotting Shell gas.
It's huge, and it's bigger if you write to Shell and tell them you are not using it because of this and that. They are scared of that. If they know people know, we hope they will change. Because it's so important they change. Because they are creating poverty. That is the end result of what they're doing. They create poverty and then try to make us beggars in our home.